I'm someone who loves trying out different makeup looks, but doesn't really wear much on a daily basis, so I like to focus on making sure I have high quality staples. And whether you like a fresh face, full glam, or somewhere in between, you've probably seen Thrive Cosmetics' viral tubing mascara. I've certainly seen it everywhere. You know the one in the turquoise tube? So that mascara, along with all of Thrive Cosmetics' beauty products, are certified 100% vegan and cruelty-free, which I look for in makeup, and they've got excellent quality to match. And something I didn't know from all the mascara videos I've seen is that for every product sold, Thrive Cosmetics donates either that same product, another product that is needed more, or a monetary donation. They've worked with over 500 nonprofits to help with a wide range of causes like supporting cancer survivors, people experiencing homelessness, education access, and so much more. Knowing that makes me feel even better about using their products. And I do enjoy using them. Like I said, I like having high quality staples, and so my favorites are products that are multi-purpose, like the Brilliant Eye Brightener. It comes in a bunch of colors, and I like using them as eyeliner, eyeshadow, and even highlighter. Thrive Cosmetics is luxury beauty that gives back. Right now, you can get an exclusive 20% off your first order at thrivecosmetics.com/thrive. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS. .com/thrive for 20% off your first order. Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
It's time for the Life Writing Podcast with your hosts, authors and screenwriters Stephen Barnes and Tanana Reeve Du. All about creating the project of your dreams while living a balanced artist life. Be the hero or heroine of your own story. Sponsored by LifeWritingPremium.com. Get ready to write for your life.
Welcome to the Life Writing Podcast, where married authors and screenwriters Stephen Barnes
and Tanana Reeve Du talk about writing during stressful times, breaking into Hollywood, and balancing life.
Every week, we'll share more tips on how to build a better life while you create your dream projects.
Even if it's only at the rate of one sentence a day, life writing is the application of the tools of writing to life and the tools of life to your writing.
Hey, everybody. Welcome. We are so excited to be back with a live podcast. We had a rerun last week with New York Times bestseller Leigh Bardugo, who is always great to talk to. But our guest today is going to be amazing. Not only a writer, but also the rare guest who's an actor, David Dasmalchian, who is burning up the internet with buzz over his new film, Late Night with the Devil.
God, I love that movie.
And so many other projects he's been involved with and brings such special qualities to. But before we bring David in, honey, you know what we do about this time. Why don't we talk about, you know, what's going on? What's going on is we have a great guest today, but we also have a lot of other stuff that's going on. So, you know, gentlemen first, although warning, let's be super oblique. We're working on a very special project that we're not really.
Yes, working on a very special project. We can't talk about it too much, but it does involve writing and it does involve Hollywood. And we have about another week, actually less than a week, to turn in what we're doing on it. And it is potentially transformational. If we do this right, it's going to lead to an amazing, amazing opportunity. So it's both an amazingly good thing by itself, and it is also the doorway to an even better opportunity. So it's an audition, in a sense. It's a paid audition.
Yeah, it's a paid audition. It also feels like paid learning, you know, as far as I'm concerned.
Absolutely.
But yeah.
But it's under pressure, and it can be difficult to remember that even positive stress is stress. And that, you know, it hits you. And so you have to center yourself. People often think, well, if it's good news, I'm not going to be understood. No, that's not how it happens. That whether it's positive or negative, whether it's joy or pain, you're feeling it and your organism is reacting to it. So I have that. Plus I have to finish the Star Wars novel, the Mace Windu novel. I've got until the 4th or 5th of May to turn in the set of rewrites, and there are some challenging things about it. A year from now, I may talk more about why it's so challenging.
Save it.
But
save
right
it.
Now, let me just go down the rabbit hole. Let me get this done. They're always, you know, it's my turn in the barrel. You know, I'm a big boy. I put on my big boy pants, do the work. But balancing those things at the same time as maintaining family connections and supporting my good lady wife, because she's had something extraordinary happen. And so once again, positive or negative, it's stress. So Tananarive, let's go real.
That's true. Last week was pretty incredible. It started with my editor, Joe Monti at Saga Press, letting me know, we're going to delay the paperback release of your novel, The Reformatory, because it's selling so well in hardcover, which is a conversation I've never had with an editor. So that was very exciting just to begin with. But then on Friday night at the Los Angeles Times Book Festival, I won an LA Times Book Prize in speculative fiction for The Reformatory. Unbelievable. And Steve, you were there with me. I mean, it's all the authors. Everyone's dressed up in glam. It's maybe the closest we ever get to attending the Oscars. I won't say definitely, but maybe. And it certainly felt that way to get up on that stage in front of peers and my baby, and absolutely surreal and so excited. And there were a lot of great writers. I mean, Victor Laval and Lone Women, Daniel Krauss, who was sitting right next to us, and Whale Fall. So we are all very supportive of each other. But at the same time, I wanted everybody to win. You know, it's weird.
Yeah, you know, I guess the thing that was interesting to me is how little surprised I was that you won. You know, it's like, it feels like this is your moment, sweetheart.
Thank
this
you.
Is your time, and I want you taking care of yourself, because when the doors start opening and the opportunities are there, that's the time to push it. You know, there will be times when things are not going well, but right now, and I think that we've talked a lot about why The Reformatory came out so well, all the time you put into it, the degree to which you cared intimately about serving your ancestors, you know, the Stephen King is that, you know, you have not forgotten the face of your fathers.
True.
In many ways, what you have to accomplish is less important than why you want to accomplish it. And you had every reason in the world. It almost paralyzed you. It was so important
really
to you that it almost paralyzed you. So the fact that you're doing the right thing at the right time for the right reasons, I think that there are times when the universe says yes. And I think that right now the universe is saying yes to you, and, you know, bless you. I'm so happy for you.
Thank you, darling. And on that note, you know who else the universe is saying yes to right now?
Who would that be?
Our guest, David Desmaltian. That's who the universe is saying yes to. Absolutely, so much great buzz, and deservedly so, about what I call his star turn in Late Night with the Devil. But this is an actor you know, even if you don't know, because he has appeared in so many films, like even a role like in the Suicide Squad as Polka Dot Man.
Polka Dot Man brings
so much sadness and tragedy to that part.
I think that I can honestly say that I've never seen him bring less than his A game.
Absolutely.
He just doesn't seem to know how to phone it in.
Right.
You know, just that if he's going to do it, it seems like he just does it. So it's so wonderful to talk with artists who have that level of commitment and passion about what they're doing. I mean, this is such a chancy business that if you're not invested fully in it, it's best to get out of the way and let the people who have no choice but to do this, do it.
And directors see it.
David's
directors.
One of the people who deserves to be seen and heard.
You've seen him in Last Voyage of the Demeter, Oppenheimer, The Boogeyman, Boston Strangler, Ant-Man and the Wasp, so much. And he's also a writer and producer. He wrote a comic, Count Crowley, which I can't wait to talk more about that since we know him more as an actor. But everyone, please welcome to the studio, David Dasmalchian.
Wow. Wow. Thank you, guys. That was the best introduction, and my heart is so full. I adore you both as friends, but also as creators. So getting an opportunity to come and talk to you about what we do, how we do it, why we do it, when we do it. It's life. It is our lives. And
that's right.
And I'm just honored to be here. And massive congrats to Nana Reeve. I'm excited to have you sign my hard copy of the book as well.
I look forward to the chance to do that. You know, the four of us, you and I, David, just met sort of in the horror circles around LA. I don't even know when, yes, to tell you the truth, but
we just kept being brought in as like talking heads on, yes, horror stuff. And we just connected because I was really admired the interviews with you that I had seen in the past, and then the writing that I had started to explore of yours. So when I got the chance to meet you, I was very excited. Little did I know we'd actually get to become friends, or that,
isn't that wonderful?
I would find you and your amazing husband at my Halloween party.
Yes,
just who knew? Party. Life is a magical, magical journey sometimes.
Well, that party was a magical journey. I do, real quickly, Steve, I think the four of us, we met David and his wife, Eve. I think we were at a, yes, Dragula event, like a premiere.
Yes.
And we, yep, started to have a really deep conversation. And we're like, well, we have to finish this conversation. And I think it's only now 2 years later, we finally get to have the conversation. So yay for
us. We're talking about time and breath and the physics of time and the physiology of breath. It was really a fascinating conversation standing there surrounded by a bunch of drag horror icons and filthy, beautiful, incredible monsters.
Yes.
That was a wonderful night.
It was a wonderful night. So, Steve, you look like you were about to ask a question.
No, I'm always about to say something. You need to shut me the hell up from time to time. One of the things I want to make sure to touch on is the fact that when people ask me what they should study to be writers, you know, should they go to this program, that program, you know, MFAs, I say, no, study journalism and acting. You know, that journalism for the habit patterns and the discipline and learning
deadlines,
how to research and learning how to work on a deadline. Acting to learn storytelling and character intrinsically from the inside out as opposed from the outside in. And I'm not sure we've had an opportunity to speak with very many actors who are also writers. I have just noticed that professional actors who turn to writing more often than not do an excellent job with, at the very least, the characterization, but also they seem to understand plot in a way that is at a professional level, even without specifically studying writing. So I want to make sure to have a chance to talk to David about the connection. If he agrees that what I'm saying might be true, why does he think it's true? And how can someone tap into some of that? Does he have any suggestions about how actors create characters and look at story? I'm throwing that out to him because I'm hoping he's going to say something unexpectedly brilliant.
it's an important question, and it's a great question. And I think, as do the two of you, have a belief that within my DNA, there is this coded just impulse desire that probably goes back millennia to tell stories. Where does that come from? How far back does that go? I don't know, but I'll say that my writing discipline began quite young with the benefit of teachers that taught me the importance of journaling. And then my mental health journey required quite a bit of journaling and jotting down ideas and poetry and writing my feelings. And then my professional writing journey grew out of necessity. So in 2002, or in going into the 2000s, I had come out of a pretty intensive, rigorous theater training program where I'd learned about everything from Shakespeare to Tennessee Williams and Sam Shepard all the way back to Commedia dell'arte. And it really trained my body, my voice, my mind to be an actor. But I had a crippling addiction to heroin at that time that really nearly took my life. And so when I got clean on May 10th of 2002, I believed that I would probably never act again. And I began to feel like, okay, the thing that comes to me most naturally, acting, is probably gone for life, because I feared that the stress or the whatever, the something about acting was going to trigger me to relapse, or that I just wouldn't be able to handle the come down at the end of a night of performing, you know, a character, and then not have the benefit of something to soothe my body and mind. So I wrote because I needed to express myself and I needed to tell stories. And I had this story that lived inside of me that was grown out of, you know, they always say, write what you know. And from my life, I knew deeply the struggles of both addiction to substance, but also addiction to people, codependency. And so I started writing this love story about two people who are so deeply in love with each other. The only thing that they possibly love more is their narcotics. And then coming to the conclusion that they might need to break up with not only the narcotics, but one another, and how hard that moment can be in our lives when there isn't someone to come tap you on the shoulder and say, now is the time, you got to get out, because if you don't, you'll die. So I started writing and writing and writing and writing. And you know what? It forced me to go train myself, study script writing and read scripts, because at first it was a short story, then it became a longer story. Then I thought maybe it's a graphic novel. And then eventually I was like, I think this is a screenplay. And I know a lot of actors from my time as an actor, so maybe I could get this screenplay going. And that's where it grew from, Steve. It was like, I needed to tell stories. And little did I know that as that started to go, and that script, which was ultimately in the end about 79 drafts of screenwriting that evolved from a really different looking piece of clay to what it ultimately became. Friends in the theater community, after I was about 5 years clean, encouraged me to get back up on stage, and I started my acting career again. And then the two just started to feed one another. So all of my knowledge of being an actor and how to understand text and how to bring characters to life informed what I do believe is probably one of my, if not my greatest strength in writing, which is dialogue. I feel like I try to do everything I can through dialogue as opposed to parenthetical. I hate writing in the parentheticals when I'm writing scripts. I would be happy if my scripts were just nothing but dialogue, because I feel like as soon as I start saying he makes a dour face or he slams a door or this, all of a sudden I realize I am not doing my best expression. So they feed each other, and here we are all these years later, and that was the origin of it all.
What a beautiful
very quick follow-up, and then okay. I'll let Tananarive grab it. There's an implication in what you said that when you write stage direction, you're not doing your best work, which suggests to me that when you're writing stage direction, you feel like you are watching the characters rather than being inside the characters. Is there any accuracy to that?
There is obviously stage direction is necessary in many instances. I think I have a temptation of over-reliance upon it, as opposed to really And it's, you guys get this. It is a double-edged sword. It is a paradox. It's whatever you want to call it, that then, because I believe I can best express who my characters are, what their point of view is, how they exist in this world through a brief description of them physically at the beginning. And I usually try to avoid, you know, age, race. I'm even getting to a place where gender is starting to get weird for me. I'm like, I just want to, there's a few words that, and it usually is animals. I don't know why animals really help me when I do this as an actor. I determine very early on when I'm building a character, what animal my character is, but then it's about that dialogue and how they communicate and how they speak to me that will give the, ultimately the viewer, but also the director, the actors, hopefully everything, almost everything that they need.
Yeah, appreciate your, it was a brilliant answer. You were right, Steve. And also the candor, you know, so many people contact us about this podcast and say that it's an inspiration to them. So even if people aren't going through something like addiction, they have these barriers that they're struggling to overcome and look to our guests sometimes to help them, to help guide them past those barriers. You don't have to get too deep into the weeds with the details, but I'm wondering if there's any one thought that on that magical date when you stopped using helped propel you forward, like what, in an inspirational way, rather than, oh my God, I'm going to die if I don't stop this, which is fine too. But was this something else?
You know, it's an interesting, that was an interesting night. It was a dark night. I had been living in a car for quite some time, and then I had gotten a job at a sandwich shop while still living in the car. And then the sandwich shop connected me with a coworker who needed a roommate. So I was going to be able to crash at this person's place until I could pay some rent. But the sandwich shop wasn't giving me the hours that I needed. And so I then started working at a movie theater over on nights and during the day at this telemarketing office in downtown Chicago. And I was like maybe 2 months without using. I was at the movie theater. I was really good at being in the concession stand. And it was humbling because I think that's a wonderful job working in a movie theater. But I had a Bachelor of Fine Arts from a prestigious theater conservatory. I was on stage at the Goodman Theater a few years before that. And all of a sudden, here I was filling popcorn and sodas. But I was really good at dealing with the customers and getting them to upgrade. That was the big thing. It was like, upgrade, get the bigger size, the bigger size. And I would win. I won a stereo because I was so good at getting the upgrade. And so I was talking to this guy. He was so cool. We're talking cinema. We're talking about Scorsese and we're talking about Cassavetes. And I'm holding up the line. And finally, I go, oh, crap, here. And I give him his stuff. And I gave him like an upgrade for no charge. And he goes, man, that was so cool. And he goes to shake my hand and tips me with a little bag of cocaine.
Oh,
now,
shit.
Oh. I had never been a big cocaine fan. I had done a fair amount of meth. I was a speedballer, so I loved heroin. Heroin was my drug of choice, but I did sometimes like to mix the speed and the heroin. And my impulse was to go throw it in the trash, but I didn't. It sat in my pocket. And then I got home that night, and you know what I had done? This is how I knew I wasn't ready to be clean yet. I had still saved one set of rigs. Like I had one needle, one spoon, one thing of cottons under my mattress, just in case there's an apocalypse and maybe I have to perform surgery on somebody and maybe on the, you know, whatever addict BS I told myself. So I took the rig, I went out and sat in my car and I cooked up the coke and I shot it up and it felt so awful and I felt so gross. And I looked out at the stars and I was like, this is it. That was the last time I stuck a needle in my arm. It was the last time I got high. I was working with a methadone clinic at the time. I went and you had to take a pee test and then, you know, talk to a doctor and a counselor. And I went the next morning and I said, well, I screwed up, but you know, and I was going to meetings and working a program but that was, you know, it's an honor. It's an interesting, because it was a confluence of so many things. It was a lot of people, I think, in just like going back to what I said earlier about relationships and being codependent and and or whatever the thing is, people who are in a job that they can't get seem to get out of, or people who are in a relationship they can't seem to get out of, people who are struggling to pick the right thing they can't seem to get out of. Everybody we desperately want, and often Hollywood or lazier writing tells us that there's these lightning moments where the jinn will appear and say, yeah, this is what you have to do. And it just doesn't work that way. Life is so much sloppier, messier, more complex, and more complicated than that. If it was that easy, God knows, we would have not pulled out nearly as much hair as we have in our time. And I think that that's the stuff. That's the stuff to me that makes it so compelling. Those are the stories I like to tell and be told.
You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales, because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten. As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/realm.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Well, I'm so glad that you were able to come through the other side with the, only your internal guidance and your realizations. David, I don't know if you remember me telling you this, but not long ago, well, months ago now, actually, I told you Late Night with the Devil, that's going to be the one. I mean, is there any such thing as the one? I don't know. But it just has felt like the buildup, the reception, because in the horror community, especially, you're a favorite son, right? So we love you in all your roles, but horror is such a homecoming for us. And I have a feeling it feels that way for you too. So I would love to know about this watershed, like what attracted you to this project and why do you think it struck such a nerve?
Sure.
And also just how did you create your character? Great. That was, if ever I have seen you do a character with layers, you really did it there. And that character was an onion. So I really want, if the more you can give us about this, I think the more valuable this conversation is going to be.
Well, for anyone listening who is a writer and a director putting together their projects and they're trying to attract new people to join their project, for me, when I consider things that come my way, there is a number of criteria that are very important to me. The first is going to obviously be reputation of the people that I would be potentially collaborating with. And are they kind people? Do they treat people well? Are they going to create safe spaces? Do they share some of the same values that I do when it comes to what's really important in life? So that's the first check mark. Now, the way that that was checked for me with this project was producer who happens to be a friend of mine reached out to me and said, I really like these guys. I'm working with them. And I would you consider looking at it? So to me, it goes, okay, if he's working with them and I really like him and his, you know, his humanity, then we're in good shape there. So then I get the email. It's a beautiful letter. The brothers who wrote the film had read an article that I'd written for Fangoria magazine soon after my mother passed away about my love of horror hosts and the importance of the people who kind of like Charon carry us across the river Styx into the darkness sometimes, and sometimes are there to greet us when we come back out. And they really responded to this article and they thought that my talents as an actor would lend themselves well to this role. So then I go, instead of going right to the script, which this will be, you know, a little hurtful for some of us who are writers in here, but sometimes my time is so limited and I can get a lot from this one tool. I'm not saying it's necessary for everybody, but boy, was it helpful for me with this one. They had included a digital lookbook, kind of a vision of what they wanted this film to look like. And what they had done was they'd taken kind of the old TV guide template and, you know, put in all of their own stuff to make it me, as if I was in this, you know, like it was an old Night Owls, you know, expose and coverage.
That's great.
And it really sucked me in. And so then I start reading this script and I go, okay, this script is awesome. The idea is so cool. The role, the thought of the role scared the real living daylights out of me because it seemed like something I'd never attempted before. And it felt like it could be just a few clicks out of my capacity. So what I said to myself was, historically, when things scare me, that fear is often a really important place for me to try to walk through. There's a difference, mind you, between fear and intuition. If my intuition says no, then you listen to it. But fear of failure, fear of not having what it takes to rise to the occasion, that is a real, real, if you're willing to go there, it's a real important place to try and walk through. And I'm so grateful that I did walk through it because ended up being a life-changing experience.
I'm glad. I'm glad to hear it feels like a life-changing experience. Go on, honey.
The expression on your character's face when he's interviewing his dying wife, a kind of a frozen smile. I get the feeling that you found it easy to relate to how a person can moor themselves emotionally to someone that they love that helps keep them sane and balanced. That you, it was very easy for you to think about your relationship with Eve and that sense of, oh my God, who would I be? That real terror, a man who wants success, but ultimately the meaning of life is to be joyful. Everything else that we do is to find our way to that joy, you know, to move away from pain, embrace joy, and be of service is the way I would look at that. How did your relationship with Eve inform your performance?
It was, you know, this being able to mine our personal resources, mine our personal realities, and find a way to allow those to propel us into the stories that we're trying to tell. I found in thinking about Eve, in making Late Night with the Devil, and in making Late Night with the Devil, which made me think about Eve in a fun way, led to the confrontation with myself that I had to really to take on in a kind of reckoning sort of way, where much like Jack Delroy in the film, I have, over the 15 years of my relationship, allowed moments of my journey to become so overwhelmingly about the needs of my work, the drive that I have that can be almost, well, not almost, often difficult to have to be around. I have pushed myself and my family at times in ways that I think, looking back now, I obviously feel a great sense of grief over sometimes. And I've spent the last few years actually in developing and building new tools and new skills so that ultimately I can rely on myself to support myself when I need myself the most, as opposed to relying upon Eve or even the kids to need to be that safety net for me, or that support system, or if I have to go dive deep into, you know, a really intense process somewhere that I don't need to always have them there with me. So I thought about that, and I thought about this guy that I wanted to help manifest and bring to the screen. And I thought, how boring would this movie be for me as an audience member if it's about a guy who wants so badly to be successful that he's just going to sign a deal with the devil that says, okay, make me rich and famous, kill my wife. That's not what this movie's about. That's not at all what this movie's about. No one who loses themselves in the hell of what Jack loses himself in, and no one who loses themselves in the hell of what I have over my lifetime at different points lost myself in, does so with the, I don't believe, maybe there are those rare exceptions, you know, there's one or two we see on our news a lot, but I think there's this, it's not as conscious. It's you really believe you're doing the best. You're working this hard because you're going to support your family. You're willing to sacrifice everything because you know it will provide the dream. And that was something I could really hang on to. And therefore it never felt like Jack was just this narcissistic, you know, smarmy guy that I never believed that. I believed Jack really cared and deeply loved his wife, even though his neglect, his workaholism, his inability to just take his cigarettes outside once in a while because he's working these crazy hours and she's having to take the side smoke. It's like never in a million years would he have signed up for this. But it's how it happens, you guys. It's more interesting to me. It's more real that way.
Yeah, that fresh-faced radio host where we see like the very first time he's on the air, so different from the guy he became. Yeah, Steve, were you about to say something?
Well, just the seduction is one step at a time. You don't end up where you think you're going. You're always going to turn corners, and there's a different vista every time you do, and you make another choice, and then you make another choice. I was thinking about two things. One is that you have to love your character. And the second one is that I get the feeling that you're learning how to love yourself more.
I am working on that diligently every day. It's so much work. I will tell you guys this, and for those listening who feel confident enough in their work to walk into any agent or any studio office and slap that script or that manuscript down on the table and say, here I am, hear me roar, get in there. I've always had that. Isn't that interesting? I always had that self-confidence. I always had the ability to stand on stage with the footlights beaming up and deliver, you know, a Tom Wingfield monologue or whatever. I mean, of course it scared the crap out of me. And of course it was hard and it was demanding and it was always, you know, stage fright and all that, but I still had the confidence to just be out there. What I think I was really missing was the self-worth to believe and understand that I was safe, that within myself, I was enough, that people weren't waiting to leave me. That's been a constant kind of narrative that I have allowed to play its fiddle for far too long in my 48 years of the internal voices. People are just waiting for the next best thing to take off. It's kind of what you would in modern psychology ascribe to abandonment anxiety, as well as having kind of an anxious attachment style to attachments, security figures. Interestingly, I just wrote a script where all the knowledge I've been accruing, learning about how we attach to our attachment styles, I've written a script. It's in the horror space, and it follows a number of characters, but my three main characters, I decided to make one of them anxiously attached. One is anxious avoidant attachment, and the other one is an avoidant attachment style. So you get kind of all three and how they go through hell together. Very interesting. But yeah, Steve, you're right. I mean, I love my characters. I love the work. I love sometimes many things more than I am able to love myself. And loving ourselves doesn't mean just like doing what we want to do or just spoiling ourselves. It's much deeper than that. It means doing the really, really hard work, the really uncomfortable work, and trusting that you can count on yourself.
Beautiful. You're obviously such a writer too. The way
thank you so much
yourself.
For the honesty of that answer was just great. I am profoundly grateful that you feel safe enough with us to express yourself like that. That's a real gift, David. Thank you.
And another aspect of Late Night with the Devil that I love, I'm a big fan of child actors, and you have a co-star, Ingrid Torelli, who does such a fantastic job in her dual role. I don't want to give away too much, but you know, sometimes, and I know this as a writer who writes a lot of child parts, sometimes it's tough to sell projects where there are child actors involved. I don't know why they get such a bad rap, because when they're on screen, they're freaking captivating. What was it like to work with this young lady? And yeah, what, how was she so well prepared and in your scenes together?
She was just one of the many gifts that was part of this film. I mean, these are all local Australian talent. We capitalized on some incredible incentives and rebates from the Australian government. That's why the film was made there. The director, writer, duo, Colin and Cameron Cairns are Australian natives. The camera team, the art team, everybody, the cast, completely everyone was Australian except for yours truly. And Ingrid, very incredible young woman, teenager who had, I think, done a big play. She had been in the stage adaptation. She'd done a big play, but I don't think she'd done much on camera work yet, but she just got it. She just got this character, and she was so scary, you guys. When we'd be on set and she'd give me these weird little smiles and she'd say these weird little lines and she'd do these things, freak me out. But sweetest teenager, such a kind, wonderful soul. She actually babysat for Arlo and Penny sometimes so that Eve and I could go out on a date. It was amazing.
That's great that you would trust her to babysit your kids
while she's demonically terrorizing me on stage.
Well, absolutely. I don't want to give away too much for people who haven't seen the film, but I don't think it's any secret that she has a demon within her. And I think the whole question throughout is like, at what point does she begin and the demon end and vice versa? Because just the fluidity and the love of the camera and the love of the audience, I'm like, whose love is that? Is that her? Is that the demon? But in any case, you know, one last thing before we move on to other topics with Late Night is that I know you've talked about this, and unfortunately, sometimes audience members are hearing more about controversial aspects of the film even before they've seen it because of the use of AI and some of the interstitial material. And I think there's kind of a misunderstanding out in the public that AI was used instead of an artist rather than an artist implementing AI. And I wondered, you know, how has that been, and how would you like to talk about that?
Sure. We made the film two and a half years ago in Australia. And at the time, there are these three kind of cutaways from the live broadcast to commercial break. and those little images that come up on screen where it says, you know, like, we'll be right back or stay tuned. The team, which is this tiny little family of filmmakers, Colin and Cameron and their, you know, graphic designer, who's also one of the producers, a friend of theirs, who's also shooting stills on set and who's also helping wrangle sodas for us when we're shooting. It's like, it's a very small operation. We had very little money making this movie, but they were playing around with whatever the AI app at that moment was, and, you know, typed in like Halloween special, da 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 da. So they got this imagery that they thought was cool. And then the graphic designer expounded upon that and used the template and changed, you know, colors, or did his own spin on stuff. But ultimately, at the end of the day, that was, you know, recognized and called out. And I think the brothers released such a really much more prescient statement than I could sum up here. But from my point of view, what I felt like was, you know, I'm sad that the guy who did all this incredible work putting the so much of the art for our film together, that has been the story, because I feel like he did so many things that I wish he would get, you know, recognized for. But beyond that, it's the only thing that makes me sad is when people read or don't read, they see clickbait and there's been, you know, been word out there that like, oh, Late Night with the Devil is an AI movie, like a quote of that, like AI movie, which that would imply that like the movie was written or made or produced or the performances or the special effects or any of that was done with AI. No, there are three interstitial images. They, you know, comprise maybe 15 seconds of the film that were originated out of AI. Absolutely true. The conversation has grown so much in the couple of years since we made the film, and I'm so grateful that it has. I'm grateful that our film has been a springboard for the continuation of the conversation. And when people say to me, you know, are you upset that people are boycotting the film or that people are, it doesn't bother me. I think people having strong convictions about this stuff is really important. And I would absolutely have a different approach to if we were doing the movie right now than what I thought about stuff a couple of years ago. For sure, I've learned so much, and I say when people, you know, say that, well, they're going to boycott or they're going to protest the film, I think if that's what your, you know, your heart says, you have to listen to it. I would never ever tell somebody that they shouldn't do that if they feel strongly about something. But I'm really grateful for the conversation. I know it's only going to continue. And you two, as prolific and important writers, we all can see what's so frightening and why this is such a triggering issue and what's so scary about it. So yeah. I have no hard feelings, and I just hope everybody is, you know, up educated on what the whole facts are, and then they can make their follow their hearts. You got to listen to your heart.
Well put.
It's here, and trying to figure out how to navigate this territory with ethics and with care, and as artists and as consumers, this is the conversation that needs to be had, or our grandchildren are going to be unhappy with us that we did not have it while there was still time to ask ourselves, how shall we enter this new world? Yeah. So, God, and I'm sorry. I hope that it seems that Late Night with the Devil is doing good things for the people who made it, that the controversy is not hurting the reception and the opportunities and the doors and the expression and the connections. So the fact that you welcome the opportunity for people to honestly express what they're feeling, that to me, that says that you have never lost the part of you that stands in the living room and does that Buddha baby thing, earth below, heaven above, no one in the world like me. You've never lost that, and that you protected your heart. You did whatever it is you needed to do to keep that essence alive, because that part of you, surrounded by loving people, can afford to hear a criticism without it diminishing your sense of self. To be able to hit that point where you can give everything from vulnerability, but still kind of, I watched you when you were talking about this, switch into your adult self to discuss the business aspects of this. And it was beautiful to see you go back and forth between that charming, sweetheart, totally open little boy and a thoughtful adult philosopher about the business. That I see both of those personalities in you, but it's great.
Thanks, man. Thank you. Thank you. That is my most present adult brain self that needs to steer clear of reactivity. I want to be present. I want to listen. I can get dysregulated so easily. It actually kind of breaks my heart at my age to see how often. And the last couple of years, again, have compounded that realization of how deeply I can be benefited by the power of therapy, meditation, you know, mindfulness work, even trance work. And when something like this comes up, of course, your heart sinks. You look at the internet, you look at the comments on your things. I have luckily gotten a little bit of practice with that the last couple of years, because I am pretty vocal when I am mad about things like children being put in cages or trans youth being targeted or put in danger, and a whole long list of things that I've kind of said, I'm just going to say how I feel. But it can be hard sometimes. And then you look at your phone the next day, you haven't looked at your phone for a day, and you see like, oh boy. But the ground is below, heaven above. I'm here, man. We got to let everybody have, as long as they're speaking with dignity, and they're treating others with dignity and kindness and trying to do their best to be diligent about facts and data.
It amazes me.
And we can hear it all.
If you take the position that you have, I have lost friends because I said that being honest, kind, and efficient is a good thing. I mean, the three gates, you know, asking yourself, is it true? Is it kind? Is it useful? Literally, I had, and that shocked me. I'm not that easily shocked anymore, but people, you know, insisting that they had to be able to lie. They had to be able to be unkind, you know, in order to function in the world. I'm thinking to myself, how far have you strayed from the spirit that you were when you first looked out at the world and hoped that there was a place for you?
You're writing that down. True, kind, useful.
Yes, it's the three gates. The Persian poet Rumi said, before you speak, let your words pass the three gates of your mind. And the three gates are asking yourself, is it true? Is it kind? And is it useful? It is a complete ethical system in a box that doesn't require religion at all. And in fact, I wrote an article for Magazine of Fantasy, actually for Analog, I think, or Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, on using the three gates to program AI to act ethically. But that's another thing. Tanara wants to move on to a different subject.
Yeah, I do. I do, because just based on what you were saying, David, and speaking of the three gates, actually, you know, this business attracts people with a lot of different personalities, a lot of unhealed trauma. You know, I think everybody has that. But so often we do see bad behaviors. We do see people who turn into assholes who otherwise maybe would not have been assholes. And I'm wondering what is your most, if there is one, your most important tools for centering and also for checking yourself, right? To make sure that, you know, as your friends will say, never change, David.
You got to surround yourself with people who love and support you at the end of the day, no matter what. You have to have some kind of program. I don't know what your program needs to be. I'm not here to tell you what your program needs to be. If you're listening to this, your program could be the 12 steps. Your program could be the tenets of Buddhism. Your program could be a particular meditation process, a therapy process. For me, it's an amalgam, or if that's the right word, it's a toolbox, I should say, of many different programs. But having a safe place where you can go, a safe place being in the metaphorical sense of place, like the people that you surround yourself with, the people who believe in you and who support you and want to see the best for you. and that, you know, you can do that. And I think for anybody out there who is an actor, a writer, a director, who's a creator, have something outside of the work that you love. For me, comic books, working with models and miniatures, watching old classic horror films, spending time with my kids, going for walks is a big part of my mental health process. Yoga has been a really big thing for me. I do yoga every morning, and if I can't do long, it's okay. Be kind.
Yoga is the best. Yoga is no longer optional for me. If I don't do it at least three times a week, my body starts remembering how old I am, and I don't want it to do that.
Like to live under the illusion. But yeah, absolutely. Well, you brought up comics. We would be remiss not to talk about your comic, Count Crowley. So for people who just know you as an actor and didn't realize you were in the comic space, tell us about that and what it was like to work on that.
I'm really proud of Count Crowley. It was originally an idea that I manifested a long time ago in my youth, where I thought, how cool would it be if there's a late night horror host? Because I've always loved the late night horror host, who secretly was actually using all their knowledge and wisdom from the horror world to fight and defeat the monsters that live in the world. And then I got older and I wrestled with all of the struggles that, you know, I've talked about today, my battle with addiction, my mental health struggles. And I thought, how amazing would it be as I entered into going into 2015, 2016, and there was all this powerful messaging coming out about how there's fake news. And if you criticize somebody, they would just say, oh, it's fake. I don't listen to the reporters. Don't listen to the journalists. They're all lying. I may be standing in front of you doing something absolutely horrible, but it's a lie. Like the manipulation of the media, I was like, wow, this is powerful stuff. So I came up with this idea of a hero named Jerry Bartman, who is at the bottom of the bottle. Their career is over as a news journalist and as a reporter. And the only job they can get is being a horror host. And turns out that not only are monsters real, they've been feeding fake news and information through the media and through literature for generations as a way to kind of distract us from the presence that they have in our society and the way that they're trying to get vengeance on humanity. And thankfully, Dark Horse Publishing loved the idea. We're now, the third volume of the book is currently in comic book shelves as we speak. Issue
Congrats.
Three is out now. Issue Yay. Four comes out soon. And then that'll be compiled into another trade paperback. And then we'll have three graphic novels and hopefully many more to come. And I say to all of you, as I said when I was talking about writing my first screenplay, which became the movie Animals that I wrote and produced and acted in, write what you know, but that doesn't need to be literal. Yes, Animals is about heroin addiction and about codependent relationships. So you would say, well, David, that's very literal. Sure. Count Crowley is all of the stuff that I wrestle with and think about in battle, but through the lens of werewolves, vampires, late night horror hosts, crypt keepers.
Yeah, so that's the only way to do it.
Big thought. I want to.
You've been extraordinarily generous to us, but we know we have to let you go.
Yeah, we know your schedule better than you do, David. So we got to kick you out of here. But thank you so much. What a great
guest
you are.
You're wonderful,
thank you so much for your generosity and insight and all the things. You go off and be famous and promote the hell out of Late Night with the Devil so that everybody sees it. And thank you so much for being with us. You can find David on Instagram. He's very active on Instagram. I think that's probably the best place, right, David?
Yeah, definitely Instagram.
Find him on Instagram. So that David Dasmalchian, and go on, Steve.
That's great. I just like to say that people who enjoy these kinds of conversations will like our writing course at www.lifewritingpremium.com. We care about artists. We care about writers. We care about telling the truth and being kind and forwarding your career. So if you'd like conversations like this, check us out, www.lifewritingpremium.com. I'd like to, you know, David, my eyes were locked on you the whole time. You're just magnetic. And
well, let me just say before I go, if you're listening to this and you're looking for people to help inspire you, guide you, I highly, highly, highly recommend going there, looking into this. It's an opportunity for you to engage with two of the, you know, strongest writers, but also most wonderful people I know. So on that note, much love.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
What a great note to end it.
T, take us out.
Yeah, well, you know how we do it at the Life Writing Podcast. You go out and make yourself the hero or heroine in your own story.
the hero in the adventure of your lifetime. Take
care. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Life Writing Podcast. Join us next time for more conversations about creating the project of your dreams. For more information, go to lifewritingpremium.com and get ready to write for your life.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Here's a quick question for you. How did you sleep last night? If your battle for a good night's sleep feels relentless, I have the answer. It's a podcast called Sleepwave, with meditations and hypnosis created to help you fall asleep. My relaxation techniques will help you feel calm and ready for sleep with soft music that will help you fall asleep in minutes. Most listeners never hear the end of an episode. So search Sleepwave on your favorite podcast app and find out why over 1 million people have fallen asleep to my voice.